Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Needles.
Needles.
Need a little help getting this meeting started. I'm here all night. Y'all ready to have an AA meeting?
Yes, I am.
Hi, my name is Misty and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting here at the Napa Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual, in our own personal stories, describes in their own language, from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker and believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them, too, and I must have this thing. So tonight, all the way from the primetime group, is the most handsome man in this room, Charles.
I don't know what I'm going to do with that. I think I'll blush for a minute and then I'll get over it. I'm Charles. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Lisa, for asking me to do this. I was taught early that anytime somebody asks you to do service, you say yes and then figure out how to do it. And that's what I do. I am a product of Atlanta, Georgia. I was born at Crawford Long Hospital. I grew up in East Cobb. My father was at Lockheed. I was here until I was about 6 or 7 years old, and then we had a big change in the family, and we moved to Athens, Georgia, which was okay as a kid. Not quite as fun as here, but it was all right. You know, one of the things that I always think about when I'm telling my story is how difficult the first step was for me. Because for a long time, and when I say a long time, understand I got sober at a very young age. But for a long time, I lied to myself about what my drinking was. And the hardest thing for me to do was to admit, not just to understand or to know, but to admit, to be able to say that I drank without choice, that I did things, I behaved a certain way without choice in the matter anymore. And that's what brought me to my knees. And I hope that anybody that's new here, if you don't find anything else, I hope you find the truth about your own behavior and your own drinking. Most of the time, if we're here, it's probably not by mistake. Now, some of us get here too early. That's a thing. I got here too early the first time. I just wasn't ready to do this. But back to my story. So, grew up very happy. What I remember being a great childhood. Both parents in the house, two sisters. I'm the middle child between two girls, which is just a nightmare in itself. Still today. So when I was 6 or 7, we moved to Athens. I was a child from the 70s and the early 80s. So when I was almost 13 years old, I turned 13 in 1980. So my dad worked for the University of Georgia. We did everything. Everything that we did was about the University of Georgia. It was about sports. It was about activities around cultural things from the school, because that's what it was. So I grew up in a fun time. When I look back at it now and I think about what was happening around me, that was a fun time to be there. The music scene in Athens, Georgia was as good as the sports teams were back then. It was a lot of fun, and no, I wasn't at the Red Church or at REM, but all of my friends, whether they were or not, will tell everybody in their life that they were there. So, but I wasn't there. But I did grow up on that, and a lot of good music, a lot of fraternity parties. You know, my parents were heavy drinkers for sure. They drank all the time. That was their social activity. Everything was lubricated with alcohol. All of our family events, social events, revolved around alcohol. I didn't think anything of it. I picked up my first drink when I was 9 or 10 years old, and it was, you know, stealing from the pool bar from the neighbors, or breaking into somebody's house, or going into a neighbor's house and stealing liquor. I think the first time I got blackout drunk was peppermint schnapps. You know, that's almost as embarrassing as what my first concert was, Loverboy. But I still can taste that. I'll promise you that. That was not a good way to get sick. It still makes me throw up a little bit. But I got, you know, I was with some friends, and it was kind of, I was kind of the pack leader, and I got really out of control drunk really fast. And the other guys that were with me didn't do that. And, of course, I noticed that, and I think they noticed that too. So I started to change running mates, and started to separate myself from the guys that I had grown up with, that we were trying to do the right thing, and I started a path to doing the exact opposite of the right thing. A lot of my inventory over the years has been about, especially early on, has been about, well, what made me different? What made me go left when everybody else just stayed straight and did what they were supposed to and went to school? I stopped going to school probably in the 9th grade, and just never. School was a social activity for me. It was a way for me to get out of the house. It was a way for me to find some way to do whatever it was that I wanted. I was always the guy across the street from the school, sitting in a car instead of going to school. I would show up and I would be late, so I'd have to sign in at the office, and you know, all the comments and stuff from the ladies in the office. You know, all of that kind of interaction with the world around me started to give me a message, and the message was that I was bad. And you know, early on when I was a kid, I found myself in some trouble. And when I got in trouble, you know, I got a lot of attention, and it wasn't a bad thing, because it gave me the attention that I actually really wanted from people around me. It wasn't good attention, but it was attention nonetheless. And I kind of latched onto that, because what I had started to do was I had started to compare the way I felt on the inside to all you guys outside. So the way you looked, I thought, wow, I'll never be that. I don't feel that way. I'm not as together as that. So I started that very early, and that was a losing proposition from the start. But that's sort of what I built. So the minute I found that peppermint schnapps, it was my medicine. It really, it tasted horrible. It felt horrible the next day. It felt okay the night before I started spinning. And once that happened, that's just what it was. And so it was my elixir, and I know we all talk about that in our stories, but it really was. It really offered me a way to calm down, a way to feel like I could be what I saw other people doing. And so I sought that. I sought that out. And so I had to change. Like I said, I had to change friends. I had to change playmates, playgrounds. I had to do a lot of things to justify what I was doing and how I was behaving. I was the kid always in detention. I was always in the hallway, in the principal's office. When I was 12, I left some stuff on the kitchen table before I got on the school bus and went to school. And my parents found it, and because they got home before I did, and they called the police. And so at 12 years old, I'm being interviewed like I'm some big criminal, right? But I'm being interviewed by the police, and there's a guy in the room, and he seems to be kind of the pack leader. And so this guy's name was John, and he became an angel in my life, believe it or not. But at first, he was my probation officer. And I met John when I was 12 at that first instance, and I stayed on his list and on his radar until probably the rest of his life. He did come to see me sober. He came to my 10th anniversary, and I talked to him on my 20th anniversary on the telephone. And but boy, I hated the sight of that guy. I had a lot of trouble. I became sort of a criminal, really. I broke into houses. I stole cars out of the parking lot at school. I got caught selling things at school and other places that I shouldn't have been. I did a lot of that kind of stuff. But what I was really trying to do was fuel a habit that I was starting to develop, and that was that I like to drink and I like to do other things. And as a kid, it's easier to get other things than it is alcohol. And so that was a big part of what I did as a young person. A lot of other things. And in 1980, in September, 2 weeks before my 13th birthday, I went to a football game with some older kids, and they were given instruction on where to meet after the game for my parents. And at that time, there was an open end to the stadium that had a set of railroad tracks on. And so that's where we wanted to go. And so I went with the older kids. And I remember, I blackout drank all day long, but I remember drinking out of a straight out of the Jack Daniels bottle, like it was a soda. And I remember going down smooth, and I remember the attention that I was getting. I remember people thinking, oh, wow, look at this little guy. He's going after it. And I would drink, and I would black out, and then I would throw up, and then I would drink some more. And I did that all day long. And at 12, I think I was about this tall. I really don't know how tall I was, but I was a very small guy at 12 years old. And all day, that's what we did. That's what I did. And the older kids dropped me off. They leaned me up against a tree where I was supposed to meet my parents. My parents found me. They could tell by my clothes and what I smelled like that I had been drinking all day and that they were just not sure. There was 150,000 people in a town that had two ways out. And one of the ways was the way to the closest hospital. So my father grabbed me by my arm and walked me 3 miles to the hospital. And I remember a little bit of that because I was coming in and out. But I remember a little bit of that walk. I remember that tug, you know, when my legs would give out, he would just pull me. We got to the hospital. It was all pretty surreal. But the one thing I remember is the doctor whispering to my father in a side conversation, and he was really telling him what had happened, and he had this yellow lab report, and what he was telling my dad was that I was that I should have been dead, that I had that kind of alcohol content in me. And you know, like probably a lot of you are thinking in this room, what I took from that was I'd love to have that little sheet of paper, because that's great news. That's a big bragging point for me. So I remember wanting that. I remember the rest of the week, just the kind of stuff that was happening. My mother, bless her heart, she literally declared war on me after that. She said to me, I declare war on you. And we warred for a long time, and we finally stopped after a while, but we did that for a really long time. Didn't make it out of school. I had gotten myself in so much legal trouble that I ended up in regional YDC at 16. And I was going to either go to Alto, which was little boys, big boy prison when I was a kid, or my probation officer had brought me this brochure from this treatment center. And he said, you know, do you think that you got a problem? And I said, well, you know, if I say that I got a problem, you're going to send me there. If I say I don't, you're going to tell me I'm lying and that's the way it is. because I'm a special kind of smartass. That's what I thought was the right thing to say. And so I went back to jail from that meeting, and I went in front of a judge, and I realized what was about to happen to me. And I didn't want that to happen to me. That was the year that I watched 4th of July fireworks on television from jail. And I swore to myself that I'd never do that again. I just would never do that again. I had created a life by the time I was 16 that's where I was. That's the best I could do. That was it for me. So I opted to go to treatment because I was too scared to go to jail. And I went to a treatment center, and I'm thinking that, you know, they're going to take me to this nice sprawling campus and, you know, nice buildings like a country club kind of place. But instead, they took me to Austell, Georgia, to an old grocery store that had plywood on the windows. And they took me inside, and there's all these kids, you know, happy and bouncing around. I was like, oh, my God, what's happening? Long day of intake or whatever, and then they walked me into this room that was about 10 times the size of this room, and there are 200 teenagers in this room. And when there's that many, there's two guys in front of this room full of teenagers, girl side, guy side, and when that many people want to say something, right, raising your hand is really not going to get noticed. So they did what they called motivated. And they would start flailing their arms around, trying to get the person in the front's attention. And so when 200 kids do that at one time, I'm like, oh, you guys have brought me to the wrong side. This is not the side for me. I spent 9 months in that treatment center. I got out. I was 18 years old. I had almost a year. So I started going to my first AA meetings. I always thought, while I was there, I did a lot of good work. I never want to discount that. It saved me. It definitely saved me. It was 12-step based. I was taught a lot of great things there. I got a lot of stuff done. When I got out, I started to think about, you know, I'm really too young. And I really should be able to drink like a normal person. And so I convinced myself that that's what I wanted to do, when really that's never what I wanted to do. I never wanted to drink like a normal person, because a normal person doesn't know how to drink like I know how to drink. So I made a plan, and, you know, sometimes when somebody... You know, sometimes when you say you've relapsed, that means that's making the assumption that you have done something, that you have become, that you have recovered, and then you relapsed. I never really had that connection to recovery of any sort. I really had just done what somebody had told me to do. It had offered me a lot of relief that I had never seen before. It had offered me a solution. It told me what was happening to me, and that there was something I could do about it. But I never really bought into that process. And so I drank again, and I love when people say, you know, my disease is out in the parking lot doing push-ups, and everybody's like, oh, that's bullshit. You know, I think what I learned was I answered the question. You know, I really thought that I could do it, that really I had learned enough, that I was smart enough, I was tough enough, I could outthink it. And I could do it, and I couldn't. And the voice and the information that I had about myself and the process and what I was doing was so loud that it took a tremendous amount of alcohol and chemicals to shut it down. And if I ever think about my disease being progressive, that's what it is. You know, when I picked up, I didn't pick up and start over as if I was 11 years old again. When I picked up and started drinking, I went straight to the moon, and I went to places that I had never been before. And I drank and did other things for about a year and a half. The last 6 months of that was black label beer. And I would scrounge up just enough money to take my bottles and trade it in for my new case, and I would sit in an apartment and drink myself to sleep every night. Anybody knocked on the front door, I ran out the back door because those weren't my people that came to the front door. That was only the people with the bench warrant. That was only the bill collectors. That was only my family. None of my people came to the front door. And, you know, when I would have people over, we would think that was funny because they would come to the back door and yell out into the yard, "Charles, you can come back. It was just so-and-so. He didn't know not to come to the front door." Again, I found myself understanding the life that I had created again in just that short time, and I was so convinced that I could do it. And so in some of those AA interactions that I had met another angel, and he was the apartment manager where I was living at the time. And you know, you can go a long time without paying rent before you get kicked out, by the way. Because I hadn't paid rent a long time, and I think he was just kind of watching out for me. But he told me if I was ever ready to come down there and knock on his door. So, December 19th, a Friday night in 1986, I took some stuff and wrapped it up in a plastic bag and put it in a hiding place just in case this wasn't the right choice. And I went down Saturday morning and knocked on Nelson's door. And, you know, he did what I thought he would do. He walked me back down the hall. He opened the door to my apartment. He stood in the doorway. He said, "Throw everything away." And I did everything except for that emergency kit I had. And I picked up a white chip on a Saturday night at the Cobb House in Athens, Georgia. And that was a long time ago. I was 19 years old. And the thing that I remember about that is that it wasn't about John, the probation officer. It wasn't about my family. It wasn't about any other circumstance except Charles. It was about me. It was about what I had done. It was about owning what it was that I was doing. And it answered my question. I have never doubted that I belong here. I've never doubted that this is the solution for me since that day. So it is of great value to me. That time that I went back and did what I did, it was research. And I kind of jokingly said that we can get here too soon, and I really just think that's what it was. I was here too soon. I definitely qualified. There was no doubt about that. I just wasn't surrendered. And, you know, the great thing about that is that I have been given the opportunity to have two lives in one lifetime. And so my life before December 20th, 1986 is one life, and the life that I've had since then is another life. And getting sober at 19 years old has afforded me a lot of opportunity to do a lot of things. I have grown up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned to do all the things because, see, when the rest of the world was preparing for life and learning things, I was drinking and drugging and not growing up. So physically, I had grown up. Emotionally, mentally, spiritually, I was still that 11-year-old or maybe that 10-year-old. You know, I was undeveloped. And so I've been afforded the opportunity to grow up a lot, and it's been quite a journey. The first 10 years, 12 years that I was sober, I stayed involved. I stayed in meetings. I had a sponsor. I had service positions. I was heavily involved. I did a lot of things. I developed a huge network of friends that were doing the same thing that I was. I know a lot of people. I knew a lot of people in those days that were sober. I know very few of those people today that have been around, but there are some people that have stuck around, and I'm grateful for that. So I decided that I might have graduated. So I, at about 12 plus years, I just kind of stopped showing up. I would come and pick up a chip, maybe a triangle, because it was that time of year, and I needed to pick up a chip, and then I just wandered off. And about 2015, one of those guys that I'd gotten sober with, we had been trying to find him, and we finally found him, and he was in the emergency room. It was Easter Sunday. And yeah, this guy had picked up a 30-year medallion and started drinking again. And he was killing himself fast, really fast. And so Kelly and I went and tried to be supportive, and he was just a different person. He was, you know, he was a caged animal, and I'd never seen him that way. I'd always known him sober. And so Kelly and I decided that when he, you know, we made the critical mistake of saying, hey, come to our house when you get out of detox, you know. Never do that, but we did.
Never do that.
We were going to rescue, but that's all right. We did it, and so he came. He came to our house for a few days, and we were talking about we need to get to a meeting. He's like, listen, I just can't. I'm not going to go to a meeting if it's where people know me. And so we looked on. I don't even know how we did it, but anyway, we found that was a meeting schedule. So we found a meeting. That was on the east side of Atlanta that he'd never been to, so he was willing to go to. And that was the Primetime Group. And Primetime Group meets Wednesdays and Thursdays from 6:30 to 7:30 at Columbia Presbyterian Church. And we actually selected it because it said it was at the Love Center. We're like, oh, that just sounds right, the Love Center. So we went to that meeting, and when I walked into that meeting, there was probably only seven people in there, and I immediately realized that I missed Alcoholics Anonymous and that I needed Alcoholics Anonymous. And that as I've been here, I have discovered how out of touch with this I had gotten, and that I am very, very lucky that I stayed sober during that time, because I had gotten myself good and crazy. And crazy being sober can be really out of control. So the second life that I've lived has been full of not just sobriety, but full of life lessons, tragedies, great things. So I got back into the middle of this, and I haven't left since, and I hope I never do leave Alcoholics Anonymous. It's saved my life yet again. It's changed things for me in a way that I don't have to come back to that place again where I say, oh, this is the best I could do. This is what I've created for myself again. Yet again, I've done this. I don't have that impending doom feeling anymore. In 2017, I had an accident. I fell, and was a near-death experience. And you know, the thing that most impressed me about that experience for me was that the whole time that I was in a hospital bed looking up at people, coming out of their mouth, they would say things like, you're going to be okay, but in their eyes, you could clearly see that you're not going to be okay. No matter what they were saying to you, you're like, wow. It was a tough situation, but the support that came from my home group and from Alcoholics Anonymous was unbelievable. And one of those groups that supported me so well was the Thursday night men's group here at NABA that meets at 8 o'clock. And if you've never been, come. It's a great meeting. It's a great group of guys. And my sponsor at the time and a group of guys from that meeting, when I got home, started bringing meetings to my house. And people from Primetime and people from other groups brought meetings to me and Kelly. And it was a fantastic experience. If I ever was to say, what's going to happen when I need Alcoholics Anonymous? That's what happened. And that happens to me wherever I go. If I'm here at NABA or if I'm at my home group, or if I'm out of town and I go to a meeting. We always find family. And, you know, that family that I grew up with and separated myself from because I was afraid, and some other reasons, that family is here. This is my chosen family, is Alcoholics Anonymous. I've done a lot of healing work with my family, and that's a great thing. And I'm kind of in a tough spot with them right now because Mom and Dad are aging out, I guess we'll say. And that's a different relationship. You know, Dad was the original superhero, and to see Dad not know what's happening to him, it's heart-wrenching. To listen to that mother that declared war on me because she was such a strong, independent person, struggle to talk to me is heart-wrenching. But I have tapped into a power in these rooms with you guys' help that will take me through anything. And I have no doubts about that. And I've made peace with my family, and I will continue to do that. And I don't want to say I look forward to dealing with it, but I certainly feel confident that what I have to take and the tools that you guys have provided me will get me through it. If I was to say anything to a newcomer, somebody that's just gotten here, I'll tell you what they told me when I got here, and that was that I'd never have to take a drink a day in my life if I don't want to. If you don't know that about yourself and you're in this room and you need to find the truth, talk to people. Look around. Talk to people. Find the similarities. Don't look for the differences in people. We are a lot that would not normally mix, but we're all here together. We all have a common thing that we're working on. You know, I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. I love what he said about tapping into the power. That gave me goosebumps. Am I the only one who found my story so similar? Exactly, right? Did you feel it? I felt it. I felt it. So I thank you very much, Charles. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mr. Tim has asked Mr. Avery to come and pass out
Miss,
to
Miss,
cool.
Miss,
that's all right. They used to call me Mr. all the time.
Oh,
Avery used to be a man's name until I got enough. You know. I know that is Adrian. I'm an alcoholic.
Please
don't fire me. And we're on a chip system here. First of all, we have a white chip, and that's like waving the white flag saying, I surrender, but I don't surrender to lose, I surrender to win. So if you need a white chip, that's it. The silver chip is for 30 days. 30 days is not easy to get. It took me a year. And the gold chip, 2 months. Then we have the red chip for 90 days. The yellow chip for 6 months, and the green chip, believe it or not, we sell less of these than any chip, because this chip is the hardest one to get. It's something about that 9 months that's not easy to get. I won't tell you how long it took me to get that. But once you get that, you're pretty much on your way to get the blue chip for 1 year, a multiple. And what this green chip do, it lets God know that you're ready to go to the blue chip. So, all the chips are here, and do anyone need a white chip? A silver chip? A 2 month chip? Red chip? We got a table for the red chip.
No, the white chip.
Oh, the white chip.
Good choice.
Okay, anybody need 6 months? 9 months? And any birthday, sneaky birthday, 1 year and more.
I actually have a medallion.
Yeah, you got a medallion.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Congratulations.
Thank you, Avery.
Thank you, Miss Avery.
I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tim.
This is our friend Tinsley. It's my pleasure to give him his 24-year chip.
Woo! All
right. And he told his story the second or third Monday night after I picked up my white chip. Something was going on in his life, and he just said, "No, I'm going to be here. I'm going to tell my story." And I had a lot of respect for him from that. But he's a musician, and I was a fan of his, and I'd black out, during his performances. And he's standing here sober. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't. All that week, I saw the flyer, and it said Tinsley E. I went, is it Tinsley? And they went, I don't know. And I'm like, oh, it's got to be. And there it was in the flesh. And he was sober. And I said, well, if he can do it, maybe I can do it.
Wow.
Thanks, thank you.
Hey, y'all. My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
and like you said, this is 24 years. And I sure didn't do this on my own, that's for sure. I tried a number of years, and that was a great story, Charles. I really enjoyed that. And just like you, I came in too early, and I think it was about 33, 34 years ago, and got my white chip here. And the stuff I didn't do, is what kept me out there ripping and running for a number of years. And an old-timer one time said that, learning what works in recovery is very valuable, but learning what doesn't work in recovery can be priceless. And some of the stuff I didn't do 33, 34 years ago was I didn't get a sponsor, I didn't work the steps, I didn't go to a bunch of meetings, I didn't learn to pray, and I didn't work with others. And consequently, I couldn't get the results of sobriety, which is not just being sober, but being happy as well. And so once I started doing those things, once it got bad enough and I came in and got a sponsor, went to a bunch of meetings and worked the steps and learned to pray and work with others, then I get the gift of recovery, the miracle of recovery, which isn't that I don't drink or drug. The miracle of recovery is that I don't want to drink or drug. So thanks for my sobriety.
Everybody, y'all stick around. There's a big chocolate chip cookie with chocolate mousse on it. We're going to try to break it up into as many parts as we can.
Wait, don't go anywhere yet. Lots of great wisdom in this room tonight, huh?
Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight. In finishing, we will take a brief...
Just another homesick child, tired of running wild, ready to stand trial and move on. Though I'm guilty in your sight, have some mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. And as I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against. Well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets its sting and the lessons fall of pain, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. From the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky, till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.